Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast. Yep, it's Eric and he's back. A little trip last week with the family. And with me as always, my co-host, Ray.
Hey, everyone.
Ray, thank you very much for holding down the fort last week. Great job with you and Don going over the secondaries. This week, we're going to continue the trend. Today, we're going to go over primary objectives with the ITC. But first, we got a little bit of tournament news to go over, though we do not have a whole lot of hobby news. Much going on in the 40K front. Games Workshop seems to be focusing on their other products for these, at least the new release of Age of Sigmar.
Yeah, they've spent last week and so far this week pretty much focusing on that, and we could probably expect that for the next 2 to 3 weeks at least.
So it's always good to take kind of a peek inside what changes they're making to Age of Sigmar, because if you kind of look out, going back and forth, 8th edition, 40K is kind of the Sigmarification, I guess I'm trying to say there. Of 40K, and so interesting to see what feedback they've gotten from both Sigmar and 40K, and what changes they're making to Age of Sigmar, and be curious to see if we see that in future versions of 40K. Of course, pure speculation at this point, but always good to take a look at what they have up their sleeve and what they're trying to work with. I know you and I were looking at the new Age of Sigmar summoning rules, and interesting, kind of an about face on how they made changes, kind of the pendulum swinging from originally it was, you know, they were free points and everybody remembers what that was like in 7th edition and 6th edition 40K. And then they went to the current system where summoned units count towards your point total. Now they're going back to a semi-free summoning system.
Yeah, it's as far as your points go, it's free. But to be able to summon, you have to work at it. You can't just choose to summon here and summon there. Depending on what army you're playing, you have to do certain steps to be able to even qualify to summon a new unit.
It feels almost very second edition, where we're also a lot like the Khorne Demonkin book. You know, as you do certain deeds that are in line with the lore of your army, you get summoning points, which you can use to bring in units. And they're also very specific of what units you can actually bring in.
Yeah. In fact, anybody who were to jump into AOS playing Khorne, they might find that it's a little bit like playing Demonkin, because what they've done in AOS is, instead of having the demons in their own codex or battle tome, and then having the Warriors of Chaos in a second one, they're actually doing everything based off of which god is worshipped. So you've got a book for Khorne, a book for Tzeentch, a book for Nurgle, and it's only a matter of time before we see one for Slaanesh as well. And then it's just all focused around building a list around the worshippers and the demons of that. So it's very Demonkin. Anybody who was looking for that Demonkin, they actually put it in AOS instead of 40K.
So we're curious to see if this actually gets ported over to 40K in a future printing or a chapter approved type thing. But right now, it's good to keep an eye on what could be on the horizon, and curious to see what happens. But without any other further ado, though, I definitely want to take a look at this past week's events. We had 3 GT level events. So after the break, we'll go over our breakdown of the 3 events that happened this past weekend.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
All right, welcome back. And this week we had 3 events. The first one starting off in Texas, where everything's just a little bit bigger. So we started with the Dallas GT, which is a fairly new event we haven't heard from in quite some time, and it's a great predecessor to WarGamesCon, which we should see in about 7 weeks from now, which is considered one of the four largest tournaments on the circuit. So, looking at the top eight from the Dallas GT, in eighth place, Michael De Hayos. In seventh place, Eric Todd with Tau. Sixth place, with Oryx, Nick Sutherland. Fifth place, Colin McDade with Adeptus Custodes. In fourth place, Anthony Bellum, making a further stake for his claim to staying in the ITC top 10, came in fourth with Tau. Matthew Ali with Drukhari, and he had won earlier in the year with Drukhari. He was one of the first to win a major event with Drukhari right after the Codex drop. So he's continuing his stake as being the one of the top Drukhari players in the ITC. In second place, imagine a Gene Stealer Cult army piloted by John Lennon. That's right, John Lennon came in second with Gene Stealer Cult. And your 2018 Dallas GT champion is Nick Auer with Drukhari, coming on a perfect 5-0. So, interesting bunch. Some of these names are familiar from our other Texas tournaments, but it's good to see that the players are starting to kind of establish patterns and making their claims for the top spot. So your winning list is a little hard to read because it's kind of a landscape list on a portrait picture.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it's a little hard to read. But the theme, and I've been talking to other folks that played at tournaments this weekend, seems to be the Cabal of the Black Heart. So that is actually his main battalion is two Archons, both with a Huskblade, and of course the Warlord is got the Writ of the Living Muse, as well as Labyrinth Cunning. He's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 units of warriors, 5-man squads, does not appear to be any special weapons. And then the elite slot, he took a Lahamian, which I thought was interesting. And then after that, the rest of the list, oh, here we go. The Lahamian, he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 Venoms, all with Splinter Cannon and Splinter Rifles. He follows that up with 3 Ravagers with triple Disintegrators. Then he starts a whole new battalion, this time Cult of the Red Grief, so Witch Elves. 2 Succubus, 1 with an Archite Glaive and a Splinter Pistol. And he gave them the relic that allows them to redeploy. Additionally, he's got... Hang on a second. Kind of duplicates itself a little bit. He's got 1, 2, 3 units of 5 Witches with a Chardonnet and Impaler. And then last but not least, he's got an Outrider Detachment of Harlequins. All with the Veiled Path. He's got a Shadow Seer with Twilight Pathways and Mirror of the Minds. And then he follows that up with not one, but two, but 3 units of Skyweavers, 1 unit of 3, 2 units of 2, all with Haywire Cannons and Zephyr Glaives. So that might be kind of the wave of the future in terms of how I could see Harlequins being incorporated into Dark Eldar.
Okay.
Because the Harlequin bikes, a lot of players used to take the Reaver bikes and throw the combat drug to give them a tough 5, you know, make them T5. The Skyweavers, without any upgrades, automatically come with 3 wounds as opposed to 2. And then you throw on the Zephyr Glaive, which gives it a +1 strength, EP -2, damage 2. So it's almost equivalent to a Hellion in terms of damage output. Not as many attacks for the points, but you're still rocking about 3 attacks per bike. But the key thing is the Haywire Cannon, because it's D6 shots at assault. So they can move at full speed. They can even advance. And as you know, Harlequins can advance and shoot, advance and charge with no penalty. So they can actually advance throwing down. So just what he's got here, he's got, so what's 3, 5, 7. So he's on average getting 21 Haywire shots on a vehicle. So we talked about last week about Imperial Knights. He's bypassing the Ion Shield because they're inflicting mortal wounds on a 4+. And then a 6 becomes D3 mortal wounds. So it's pretty effective way to take down vehicles, which is something other than Craft World Eldar struggle with quite a bit.
That's interesting information. I wasn't aware that that was becoming a thing.
That's becoming quite the thing. So it's kind of like a one half. It's funny how like one half the meta is focusing on adding knights and bigger things, and then the other half of the meta, you're seeing a lot more Haywire all of a sudden. I'm curious to see how the Genestealer cult list makes it to the second place. Let's take a look here. It says John Lennon's list. And he rocks a Primarch, a Primus, and an Acolyte.
Patriarch.
Patriarch, excuse me. What did I say?
Primarch.
Nice. Yes, he's got Abbot. He's got a Gillum in there. He happens to be a little bit infected. No, no big deal. No, no. Patriarch. Patriarch, a Primus, and an Acolyte. And then he's got two units, actually one unit of 10 neophytes and two units of 9 neophytes with a mortar. And then a unit of 18 pure strain gene stealers with pure strain talons. Follows that out with a Kraken patrol with a Neurothrope, 18 gene stealers, and 3 Carnifexes, all with quad devourers, enhanced senses, and spore cysts. And then he follows that up with a Chronos spearhead, which involves Neurothrope, two individual Carnifexes, and a Biovore, and then a unit of 6 Hive Guard, all with Impaler cannons. Well, let's take a look in terms of how this kind of performs, though, overall. So one of the things I've been kind of obsessed about is number of drops. And one of the things here he's got is, for such a large army, he's got very few drops. He's got a lot of large units. So one thing he's actually pointed out, because it looks like he's only got 9 command points, and he's figured out that 57 of his power level needs to start on the table. So, but he's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So outside of the Gene Stealer cults, he's only got 7 drops of the Tyranids, and then he's only got another 7 in Gene Stealer cult, which can all pop back and forth, you know, do their ambush thing. So ironically, he probably won't be going first that often. He's got 14 drops altogether, comparatively to our top finisher, which I think that's one thing. The secret sauce of Drukhari, which I'm finding, is the transports, because you can, especially if you're using raiders, you can get away with a couple extra units, shove them all in the raider, and count it all as one drop.
You know, thinking about it, the whole issue with the change in how deep striking works might be part of the reason why his Gene Stealer cult is as small as it is.
How so? Were you?
So he's definitely going to want some Tyranids to be able to, you know, drop into the back. But you can't deny the ability, just the power that you can have in good rolls for the Gene Stealer cults. So he might have looked at what he wanted to be able to drop in the Tyranids, and then worked his way backwards where he could still have, you know, of the 3 detachments, the Gene Stealer cult be the largest, and still capitalize on what he wanted to be able to drop in the backfield from the Tyranids.
I didn't think of it that way. You're probably right. It's maybe looking at it that, taking advantage of the exception to the rule, basically. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Let's take a look at some of the other lists in the top 8 here at the Dallas GT. Anthony Bellum, as I mentioned, he's been fighting his way into the IDC top 10. He's got a Tau list. At first glance, I kind of looked past it because it's like another cut and paste list, but he's got a couple new elements since the last time we talked about him. So he starts off with the Tau Empire. He's a Sakea Sept. I don't think we ever got an official answering on how to pronounce that. But he's got a Cadre Fireblade and a Commander and a Cold Star suit, all with 4 Fusion Blasters, so that seems fairly typical. Then he's got 3 units of 5 Fire Warriors, all with a Tactical Support Turret with a Smart Missile System. And he's got the three fire sight marksmen to really bulk out the Markolite presence. So far, nothing too exciting. Then he goes to the Vanguard detachment, this time with Farsight Enclaves. He's got another Cold Star battle suit, also with Fusion Blasters. But then he rocks 1, 2, 3 units of 3 stealth suits. And then he adds a Tiger Shark fighter bomber. I've not seen one of these in forever on the table. That's with 2 Cyclonic Ion Blasters, 2 Heavy Burst Cannons, 2 Sky Spears, Missile Racks, 2 Missile Pods, and 6 missiles. So I haven't seen that in a long time.
Wow.
And then he adds, finally, an Outrider detachment, also Farsight Enclaves, with another Cold Star battlesuit with 4 Fusion Blasters, and then 3 units of 4 Crude Hounds, and a second Tiger Shark fighter bomber.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, whoa, I haven't seen a Tiger Shark bomber in forever.
Yeah. That's quite a unique list.
All I can think of is he's... Because he doesn't have the usual firepower, which is usually like ion hammerheads or something like that that you see in a lot of other lists. Or the, you know, this, so most of the firepower looks like it's going to be coming from those bombers with the advantage of all the Markolites that he's throwing downfield, as well as all those cold. I mean, he still has the 3 Cold Star suits with the 4 Fusion Blasters. So, interesting.
Very.
I'll have to take a look at that and how he plays. So we've been teased with orcs coming out soon. What does a top 8 orc list look like these days? This comes in at, this looks like 1 basic battalion. Pretty straightforward. 3 weird boys. 3 units of 30 boys. 2 pain boys. 5 mech guns with custom mega cannons, followed by another unit of 4 custom mega cannons. A war boss relic, big mech warlord, another big mech, and then 3 units of 330 boys. So right off the bat, 240 boys plus leadership. So roughly 250 models on the table.
It takes a lot to take that out.
Absolutely. And by the way, so everyone says, okay, orcs can't play fast, can't get things done. I want to give Nick a quick shout out here. So if looking at his games, he went 4-1, losing only in the last round. He scored 33 points, 32 points, 34 points, 35 points, and in his loss, he still got 18 points. So, yeah, no 1-0 shutouts here. He's moving his models and getting them across the table as well. Best as he can do. So impressive. One more list I just want to draw attention to. This seems to be another staple, so something to be aware of is this happens to be the Michael DeHejo's 8th place finishing Inari list. This has kind of been part and parcel to what's been seeing a lot of Inari lists. So he starts with an Eldari BL-10 battalion, which is that by far is a little different. Usually you see a Latok. But he includes Yvrain as the warlord. And then he's got a BL-10 Farseer and a BL-10 Warlock. And the Farseer has Guide and Doom. That's important. We'll talk about that in a second. He's got the obligatory 3 units of 5 Rangers. Heavy support choice. He's got 10 Dark Reapers with Exarch and a Tempest Launcher. And of course, they all hang out in the dedicated transport of a Wave Serpent. He then adds an Alatok Air Wing of 3 Crimson Hunters, all with Star Cannons and 2 Bright Lances. Last but not least, he's got the Cabal, the Black Hand Spearhead Detachment. Includes an Archon, Writ of the Living Muse, a unit of Cabalite Warriors with a Blaster, and 3 Disintegrator Ravagers, as well as a Venom to transport all those warriors around. And what this involves, and we talk about the reason why I want to bring this up now, is when we go over the primary missions for ITC, this is why this list does so well. Is that the Farseers with Guide and Doom basically allows reroll hits in the shooting phase and reroll wounds. And it's you put that on an enemy unit and any unit that attacks that. So whether it's Dark Eldar or the Craft World guys will benefit from Doom. They reroll failed to wounds on a particular target. So basically, you can point at a particular unit and make sure it dies. And with all that shooting that you have in this particular list between the Ravagers as well as the Dark Reapers, that shouldn't be a big problem. And in case you don't get it done the first time, Vrain can use her psychic powers to make the Dark Reapers shoot again. So that was your adventures in Texas for this week. So that is your Dallas Open. I
want to add one thing real quick. While you were doing that, I was actually looking over Nick Sutherland's final round, that one round he lost. He lost that round to Nick Gower. And I did the math. Had he won that game, we would have seen Index Orcs win at this event.
You're right. He lost that final round 28-18. And not only would you have Index Orcs in first place, but you still have John Lennon with Index Gene Stealer Cult in second.
Yeah.
Quite an achievement there. So, again, I'm still saying that I am most afraid of that Orc Codex. They're already a strong index. Last thing they need is a Codex. I know Orc players disagree, but holy cow. On the other hand, though, Space Wolves came in last place. So. Wow. Exactly. So.
They're the sound effect we need to get.
Here we go. Space Wolf, your time is coming. A new codex is on the way. Be strong until then. All right, moving on to our next event. We're going to skip over to the Great Northeast, Bel Air, Maryland, which is right outside Baltimore, for the Bel Air Games 40K June GT. I love these very creative names. So take a look at their top eight. In eighth place, you got Jason Rumor, I'll be pronouncing your name right, with, yes, our first appearance of Imperial Knights in the top eight since the Codex drops. Actually, and Jason actually probably hails from Delaware, being part of the Ice House Warriors. It's a very popular Delaware team. Good to see them in action. Rob Triplett, also with Imperial Knights, came in seventh place. Drake Lentz of the Tau Empire with Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dice. Nice, cool team name. Fifth place, Ron Hiltz with Cult Mechanicus. Fourth place, Ken Corral with Tau. Third place, Jacob Lauer, Chukari. Second place, Rob Braun with Alpha Legion. And in first place, Scott Horas with Cadian Shock Troops. Going a perfect 5-0. Let's take a look at that. Yeah, Cadian Shock Troops.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was just gonna say, I'm seeing with Imperial Knights, and I hope we've got a list somewhere in there.
Well, as my old boss used to say, hope is not a strategy. Both Knight players neglected to upload their lists. So, but let's take a look at our first place list. This happens to be Katie and Shock Troops. I was really surprised, Katie. I've been seeing a lot of Katachan, and I've been seeing a lot of some of the other groups, but Gideon starts with HQ unit. He took an auxiliary support detachment, get Celestine, along with the two little Seraphim on the side. Then follows it up with the battalion detachment. He's got a Knight Commander Pask, as well as two tank commanders. He's got three units of 10 infantry squads, a Tech Priest Engine Seer, a Basilisk, actually two Basilisks. Damn, that page break right in the middle of the list. And he follows it up with a second battalion, also Cadian, and then he comes with a company commander, second company commander, Tempestor Prime, a squad of 10 guardsmen, excuse me, and then two unit of Militarum Tempestus Scions, six of them with hotshot las cannons, two of them with plasma guns, and then Tempestors also with a hotshot las pistol in each squad. And finally, he rounds it out with two Valkyries with multi-rocket pods, multi-laser, four heavy bolters altogether. So definitely no shortage on the command points. He's starting the game off with 12 right off the bat.
Very never seemed to have to worry about command points.
Don't think he's going first anytime soon. He's got a ton of drops. But, I mean, if you got two full battalions, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting with those. He's got those three tank commanders to start things off. I was like, ooh. You know, it's... And he's got plenty of heavy hitters as well, so he's able to take out your vehicles pretty quick. So, interesting list. I like what he's going on with here. He's got some hammer units. He's got mobility. Don't know about the board control as much. I know Celestine's sort of a forward threat, but he basically's got four infantry squads, a guardsman, company commanders, kind of keep him around in the game a little bit longer, but don't know if that's really something that would, you know, really push another army back as much, but I think the other stuff really helps out. So another variation on a Drukhari list, just want to bring this one up. This is Jacob Lawler coming in third place. And a little bit different from what we've seen previously. He starts it off with the Cabal of the Blackheart flyer detachment. That's right, I said a flyer detachment. And not just the minimum three razor wings. He's got three razor wings, all with dark lances, by the way. But he also threw in a Void Raven bomber with two Void Lances and the Void Raven missiles.
You don't see the bomber too often anymore.
No, you don't. It's that bomb load's pretty good. It basically inflicts mortal wounds on a 3+. So if you drop it on a monstrous creature or a vehicle, it's minimum of 3 dice. Against infantry, it's 1 die per model, up to a maximum of 10 dice. So it does a pretty decent amount of damage, but then it's like after you drop that bomb, it's like, yay, I've got 2 strength 9 dark lances. Anyway, the rest of his list makes it also somewhat interesting. He's got the 2 Archons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 warriors, all with shredders. Excuse me, 2 of them with shredders. Sorry, I misread that again. So he's got 1, 2, 3, 4 units of Kyberlite Warriors, 1 unit with a Shredder, 3 units with Blasters. He's got a unit of Scourges, 3 of them with Shredders. Looks like he's probably conserving some points there. He's got 1 Ravager, just the 1 all with Dark Lances, which interesting. 3 Raiders, 2 Venoms. So it looks like he's being economical with his drops at that point. And then last but not least, he's got a Cult of the Red Grief. Twin Succubi, and then 1, 2, 3 units of Witches, all with Chardonnette and Impalers. And then he's got 3 units of 3 Reavers. So looking probably using those to tie down units, because with Cult of the Red Grief, that allows him to advance and charge in the same turn. So I bet that's what he's doing there. So it looks like he's able to, that's 3, his Flyers is 7, and then Scourges is 8. And then his vehicles altogether, he still has 13 drops. So getting in there. And then looks like hovering right around that 1. Yeah, 13 command point range again. So
I am surprised at how people actually seem to have played the full 5 rounds. So I do have to say that. It looks like only the top 4 played all 5.
Yeah, they have an interesting system there. So I wonder if they had like a elimination on day 2 or something like that to kind of speed things along.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they did.
So now we're moving over to the western part of the United States with our third event, which is the Gentlemen's and Ladies GT, taking place in Las Vegas. I mentioned this to my son. He was like, what? Las Vegas opens this weekend? I'm like, no. It's just another tournament being held in Las Vegas, but it was actually held on the Strip, and a couple of friends of ours from our team were present, as well as some of our favorites that come to a lot of our tournaments on the circuit all were in attendance and shared several pictures on Facebook of the scrumptious eats. Nobody starved to death on this particular tournament, that's for sure. So looked like it was a really good time. But nonetheless, let's get to the facts. Let's talk about the top 8. And we start off with a tie for 8th place between Chris Foster and Chaos, playing Chaos Space Marines, and another Chaos player, James Cormona, who's been on the show several times with World Eaters, all both coming in at 8th place. In seventh place, Benjamin Jurek with Orcs. Sixth place with the Laytok is Chris Nelson. In fifth place, that's right, he's been playing Knights for almost three seasons now, Derek Page with Knights Renegades. In fourth place with the Talaran Army is Mitch Pelham. Third place, Daniel Olivas with Inari. In second place, Aaron Wish with Dark Angels. That's right, Dark Angels made it to the top two. But your 2018 Gentlemen's GT and Ladies winner is Aurelio Colorera with Catachan Jungle Fighters. So nice to see the hometown team win their event. Quick look at Aurelio's list real quick. He's starting off with a brigade. Don't see those as much. So the right off the start, he's got 15 command points to play with. Starts with Colonel Strachan, company commander and a Primaris Psyker. And then comes into six units of infantry squads, all seven guardsmen, a mortar, a sergeant. And so he's got the bare minimums, but he got six of those to fill out your slots. An astropath, militestum priest, as well as Sergeant Harker, and a tech priest engine seer. He's got three units of scout sentinels. And then in the heavy support slot, he's got a basilisk, a heavy weapons team, all of mortars. He's got three of those, and a manticore. So ton right there, but wait, that's just one detachment. We're playing guard here. He adds in a patrol detachment of Adeptus Custodes.
Interesting.
Yep. Shield captain on Dawn Eagle bike. What a surprise. Followed by Custodial Guard. It's got three of them with Sentinel Blade and Storm Shield. Then he's got the Valesis Praetor, so he's got the fancy flag. And then in the fast attack slot, he looks like he's got one, two, three, four, five Veritas Praetor slots. And just to make more fun, he added a third detachment, auxiliary support detachment. Darn, it's going to cost him a command point, but gives him a Calexus Assassin. So this is very similar to the list that Jeff Robinson runs. You have the large number of bodies from the guard, as well as to get you some command points. I think he's leaning a lot more towards the heavy support slots from Astra Militarum than what Jeff did, especially with the Manticore and the Basilisk in the backfield. And then he's got all these, you know, huge threats coming at you up front with the Custodes with the shield captain coming at you. So now it's like, okay, what do I shoot first? So I could see this being quite the terror of a list.
Definitely. Certainly plenty of targets to choose from.
In the earlier, I kind of scratched my head with an Astra Militarum player. He didn't seem to have as much board presence. With six 10-man squads on the table, as opposed to the other gentleman's four, plus he's got the priest in there to really help with their close combat, and then he's got two more characters to really buff them out. I could see this being a pretty difficult list to shift off those objectives. And then he's also got the three scout sentinels, you know, harassing you on the sides. So can easily see where he can be a threat. But interesting, when looking at his point totals, looks like either he's not scoring a lot of points or tying a lot of rounds or just not getting to the further rounds. He's only scoring 25 points in his first game, then 36, 21, then back up to 35, and then won the final round 19-17 over Daniel Olivas, who was playing Inari. So interesting that he's, despite all that, having difficulty getting some points on the table.
It may just mean he needs a little bit of practice with the list still, with going against some opponents.
Maybe.
Always remember, it's not just the list, it's also the player.
That is true. Speaking of players, let's talk about Aaron Wish, who came in second. As mentioned, Dark Angels coming in second. How does that happen? Looks like this. He starts with a battalion. And actually, he's butting them up with Blood Angels. So he's got a Captain, Jump Pack, Storm Shield, Thunderhammer, typical loadout, with a Librarian Dreadnought. And then he's got three five-band scout units. He then matches them up with a Dark Angel's Air Wing Detachment of 3 Ravenwing Dark Talons with Hurricane Bolters. And then last but not least, an Outrider Detachment, also Dark Angels, with a Ravenwing Talon Master Landspeeder. That's the character one. And it's also his Warlord, as well as Samael on Corvex. In his fast attack slot, he's got Inceptor Squad, all 3 of them, with Plasma Exterminators, a second squad of 2 Ancestors, and then last but not least, a Ravenwing Dark Shroud is what I'm trying to say, to round out the list.
Nice. Not a bad list.
I tell you one thing, it's got a lot of firepower and it's ideal for travel. So there's not a lot of models in the list. So interesting. And the scouts really become more of a take advantage of being able to get on objectives early. And then, yeah, the Dark Talons were very popular over in Europe. So when that Rule of 3 came out, that you heard a lot of moaning and groaning from across the pond that there were lists running 6 and 7 of those. So, but an interesting mix of the Dark Shroud, which I had difficulty pronouncing, and the Inceptor Squads. I think that's not something I've seen before, so I think that's interesting. I have to look at all that synergy and how that all works together. So, so that is your gentlemen and ladies GT for 2018. Also wraps up our GT level events and as well as majors for this week. After the break, Ray and I break down the ITC primary objectives. All right, welcome back. So last week, hats off to both Ray and Don for filling in last week and going over the secondary objectives for the ITC. Definitely one of those episodes you might want to bookmark and listen a few times over and kind of make like a cheat sheet when you approach an opponent, because there's a lot of matching up which secondary objectives work best for your army and which one works best against your opponent. So this week, Ray and I were going to tackle the primary objectives, which aren't as numerous, and they're actually pretty straightforward. However, doing that same approach in terms of what can my army do versus your army makes a big difference in terms of how this goes. So looking at a broad spectrum on how these primary missions work is not a coincidence that the ITC's flagship event is in Las Vegas, and also that the whole scoring system in terms of how players were ranked in terms of going to multiple events during the year and taking the top 5 and being bonus for playing in larger events, that was also taken from the World Poker Tour, that the primary mission score is a lot like playing poker. So the important thing to understand is what points are scored when. So there are points that are scored. First of all, what makes this very different? And if you do get a chance, it's not often we give a shout out to another podcast, but get a chance to listen to Signals from the Frontline, where Reese and Frankie talk about their experience in London at the London GT. The London GT was running book missions. So you basically, whatever happens on turn 6 determines the game. Whereas we've all been used to playing ITC missions where you score turn by turn. So it makes it a very interesting change and differential, and they go into great detail saying, hey, these are all the things we changed to get away from and to be thrown back into it, kind of, as he said, reaffirmed the changes they made to the tournament format. So back to ITC. So the idea is that you're scoring every turn as well as every round. So let's go over that real quick. What does that mean? You score at the end of your turn, so you need to do one of two things, or you can do both for extra points, is to hold an objective or kill an enemy unit. And you need to do that before your turn is over. Which means is that, yeah, you can leap forward onto an objective, hold it, and hopefully your opponent doesn't blow you off the objective. That's a big change how things used to be in 7th edition. You used to have to hold objectives through your opponent's turn. So that's one reason why Battle Company was so popular, Not only did you get free rhinos, but you could keep your rhinos on top of objectives. They had enough durability that they could withstand a turn of shooting, and you would collect a lot of points for holding objectives. So the idea, though, is where it comes into whether to go first or whether to go second, because what happens next is after both players have gone and completed a battle round, so now both players have played, who holds more objectives gets an additional point, and who killed more units during that particular turn gets an additional point. So the first things first, you got to score every turn, and the easiest ones to score is hold an objective. Even if you're holding one objective in your back of your deployment zone, hold on to something. So that's when we're reading off some of these scores, and we usually focus on the top eight, but every now and then I take a look at the bottom. I see a guy only scored like 4 points in an entire six-round game. I'm going, what were you doing? If you're just holding one objective, you get get a point. So that's a big thing. So that's where the holding, that's where you hear a lot more about board control. How many objectives can you hold? And looking at that. Second thing is being able to destroy a unit per turn. That's a big difference because a lot of armies kind of focus on, you know, especially back in 5th edition, you hear a lot about tabling armies. You really don't need to table your opponent on turn one. You just need to be reliably able to kill a unit, arguably two, and we'll go over that why in a second, per turn to stay in the game. So if you're looking at a more conservative approach, as long as I've got my one hammer unit to go around killing things, I should be okay. So going back to that earlier Nari list we were talking about, is Dark Reapers with Guide and Doom can reliably kill one unit per turn, and then the Rangers can reliably screen out the opponent from Alpha Strike so they can at least hold on to one objective per turn. So realistically, he should be getting 2 points a turn or a minimum 12 points per game. Pretty simple approach. Where it gets interesting is initiative. And the guys who designed these missions freely said that they highly favored the mission set to go second. So the idea is you have a choice. Is my army a tabling army, in which case I need to go first to Alpha Strike to really disrupt my opponent? And then hopefully by disrupting them enough, I can be competitive in the later rounds in the game. Or do I have a more of a sit tight list, you know, and go and play the game on turn two? The reason for that is, and we're going to do a little demonstration here, is where the poker analogy comes in. Ray, do you want to go first or second?
I think that would depend on what I'm playing against.
Okay. So let's say you decide, okay, we're going to roll off and, all right, I'm going first. I'd prefer to go second as well. So just like in poker, if I'm to the left of the dealer, I have to put my bet forward first.
All right.
So I play my turn, and let's say I hold two objectives, but only kill one of Ray's units. Ray now has the advantage that he knows he doesn't need to overstretch his units. All he has to do is he can either, using poker terms, call on the objectives by holding two objectives, or raise it by holding three. He doesn't have to go crazy because he already knows what I've put forward by going second. Holding four objectives really doesn't get him any additional bonuses at this point. Even if he holds, there's a one exception to that rule for one mission. But for the most part, all he has to do is get two or more objectives. If he holds two, we're tied for the round on objectives. If he holds three. So that means he can plan how much risk he needs to put into the movement phase. Secondly, I also mentioned I only killed one of Ray's units. So Ray now has to go, okay, I only have to kill two of Eric's units to get the lead at this point in that area. So now, again, he knows exactly how much he has to task of his army and which targets he can look at. So typically, I've overextended one of my units, and he can then focus on one of those, get a quick kill, also get first blood if he took old school, like we talked about in secondaries last week. And then all he has to do is what other unit is exposed and make sure I kill it. So at the bare minimum, at that point, he knows, okay, if I kill a second unit, I get an extra point. So all of a sudden, I went from having a 2-0 lead at the end of my turn. Ray doesn't have to work too hard to get a 4-2 lead at the end of the battle round by being able to score one more in each category. Let's look at another round. So I'm still going first, and this time I'm playing my usual fast attack style armies. They come racing in, and this time I'm able to take out three of Ray's units, but because I've put so many units forward, I only have one objective I'm holding. Again, Ray doesn't have to overextend himself. All he has to do is cover two objectives. He's already made up a point and taken the lead for that particular round. At this point, he doesn't have to think, so I'm going to probably win on more objectives for the turn, more kills this turn. So by Ray holding two objectives, he actually ties the round, despite the fact that I killed four units and he only killed one. So long as he kills that one, he gets 1 point, gets a second point for holding an objective. If he holds more objectives, that's 3 points. He ties, despite taking a brutal onslaught of losing four units in a single turn. So it all becomes in that positioning of what can I do? Am I in a position to hold? Am I in a position to raise what my opponent did? And that's why the advantage of going second is so important in the ITC missions. So Ray, you said if you want to go first or second, it was depending on your army and what you're playing. So what are some of your thoughts on what makes those decisions?
Well, there are plenty of lists that can very easily hide, especially with the way most tournaments do terrain. When you're in that setting, a lot of times you don't want to go first. Because to go first is to put yourself in that chance of being the guy who has more units in that first turn. Last week we talked about secondaries. You know, it's a good chance for you to give up some secondaries pretty early in the game. But also, it allows the opponent, of course, to strategize around what you're doing. They get that reaction. Now, that being said, going first can be good because it gives you the option of having more open territory to get to the various objectives. I think that's one thing that most people don't really think about too much when they automatically just say, well, I'm going to go second. Because by going second, you have to react. If you're wanting to get that, you know, one particular objective, it's a little harder if your opponent has the ability to get there quicker than you, or just has that turn advantage to get there first.
Right, it's almost crowding out is the key thing. So if you have armies which have good board control, which is basically they occupy enough space to push you back. So even if you have to literally chew through their army to get to objectives. So that orc army we talked about earlier, 240 models on the table. You're probably saying, well, he didn't have any transports, so how fast could they be? Well, he's got three weird boys, so I can guarantee he's doing the jump every turn. In which case, he's pushing forward. And then you got to remember, whatever you kept in Deep Strike, and you're expecting that great, awesome turn to counter offensive that you've been preparing since the new FAQ dropped. Well, you got to drop 9 inches away. If he's already at board center, you're essentially Deep Striking in your own deployment zone. So it really doesn't help you if they're able to get to board center first. Another reason why you may see the return of Rhino Rush, simply because that gives them that extra movement and they get a little bit of durability before the Marines, Chaos, or Loyalists, doesn't matter. So they're able to take board center and then extend out to the objectives as the game progresses.
Yeah, and one thing that's important, you bringing up the deep striking, is just how hard it is how easy it is to make that difficult. You know, you just assume that you have to have these guys, you know, within, you know, 18 inches of each other, but you don't even have to have them that close to force the unit to not be able to drop down. The smallest unit is still going to have roughly a 3-inch diameter bubble. And you have to be more than 3 inches, more than 9 inches away. So realistically speaking, you can have two units about 20 inches apart, and you can't put your opponent can't put anything in between them.
And that makes it a big deal, because all of a sudden your big strike pushes back, especially if you're looking at things like the Blood Angels, you know, deep striking a large death company, the Blood Letter bombs that have to get in close. One of the things I found out very quickly in playing post FAQ with my Blood Letter bomb is sometimes you had these narrow cones of availability to charge. And you couldn't get all 20-something bloodletters into close combat simply because you had these narrower lanes, because my opponent is better at boxing me out now. So I was like, oh, I don't know if this is still going to work moving forward. I need some other elements to help clear landing path at this point. And that's where, like, all the units with scout, so Latok Rangers, Nurglings from Demons, Space Marine scouts, because they're able to set up outside the deployment zone, so they can already set up those kind of place markers where, okay, all your deep strikers are going to have to start back, and then also add more forces as they move forward.
Yeah, and of course it's always important to look at what your opponent's list is, because that can make the difference too on whether you want to go first or second. If you see that fast army across the table, you know, you hiding your guys in the back for, you know, the top of the turn may not even do anything for you. So you may be better off trying to get that initiative and maybe getting some of the first shots in. That way, when you're getting shot, there's not quite as many guys shooting at you.
Yeah. As a general rule, fast is usually not tough. You know, so they should be, well, your faster units should be able to dive to some early shootings. Other thing to keep in mind too, when it comes to if they're coming forward, you guys did a great job explaining this on the secondaries. If their army is meant to be in your face, chances are they're going to take behind enemy lines as a secondary. So just by being in your face, they're collecting secondary points in addition to killing units and holding objectives to rack up primary points. So it becomes this double whammy. Now you start getting these larger 5-6 point turns. If you can push forward, and all of a sudden that secondary becomes a lot more difficult. And realistically, as long as you hold them out of your backfield for at least 3 turns, he's losing points every time after turn 3 on that particular secondary.
And then there is also one other thing you always want to take into account, and that is that there are models that have the ability to shoot without requiring line of sight.
And you're seeing a lot of that. So Tyranids are one of the armies that I dread right now, simply because they have access to cheap large screens. So they can put down like easily 30 gaunts, and they carpet bomb the middle of the table, so you can't get there. It's not even so much a deep strike issue. Even with movement, you may not... The Ray you mentioned earlier was a great example of the average unit having a 3-inch diameter. 30 units of gaunts can be easily 12 inches across and 8 inches deep. Trying to get your models over them, even with the fly keyword, is difficult. And what's behind them? Usually a ruin filled with Hive Guard, which do not require line of sight, and doing ton of damage on their unit of choice. Some of these guard units we've been talking about with Manticores and Basilisks in the backfield, you know, they're going to be in the back edge. You don't have to worry about running off anymore. And just large troughs of troops in front of them, or soldiers of some kind. It's going to be real hard to deep strike your surgical anti-tank units. You need to find a way to kill them from distance. So one more key tip, and this took me a little longer to figure out. It's kind of one of those Dr. Phil type things. It's so simple. Why didn't anybody think of it before? But I'm pretty stupid, so sometimes these things take a little bit to sink in. So let's go back to our previous example. I still have top of turn. Ray still has bottom of turn. So I'm holding two objectives, and I've only killed one of Ray's units so far this turn. So Ray knows he needs to kill at least one unit to tie. Which unit is he going to focus in on? Not knowing the armies in this particular case or where they are on the board map, but I've already said I'm holding two objectives. Here's a thought. Kill the unit that's holding an objective. Because I'm already holding two at the end of my turn, so all I get is 1 point at the end of my turn for holding one or more objectives. Ray then kills one of the units holding objective. When it comes out to the battle turn, oh, we're already tied at 1-1, so all Ray has to do is move on to either where my carcasses used to be or kill the other unit. So now he's killed more, and he's holding more without ever further expanding his army out of his defensive shell. So let's look at that again. I was holding two objectives, killed one unit. Ray kills two of my units. Both of them were holding objectives. So it's the end of my turn. I got 1 point for holding an objective, 1 point for holding for killing one of Ray's models. Ray still holds one objective, but since he killed both my units that were holding objectives, he's winning. He's got more objectives held at 1-0. So he gets a bonus point for that, and because he killed two units to my one, he gets a bonus point for that. Ray wins the round for the two, just on primaries alone. So it's just those simple things where if you're trying to guess, what should I shoot at for target priority? If they're holding an objective, and you're going, especially if you're going second, take those out. It's almost a double point situation.
Yeah, I think that's a very important thing to remember. So always remember that no matter how many units you kill on your turn and no matter how many objectives you control, you're going to get 1 point for each of those during your turn. Now, at the end of the round, you can get two more points, one for each of those, whether you have killed more units or held more objectives. Sometimes you can have it where both work out for you, where you get 2 points from just doing one thing. You might have an instance of you've each killed one unit and you're each holding one objective, but if you're at the bottom of the turn, you might be able to. It might be something as simple as a couple models from a unit left over from the previous round. You might be able to just shoot them off of an objective, and all of a sudden that's two more points you've been able to achieve with at least perhaps not much work. And it doesn't matter how much more, it just needs to be one more, and you get that 1 point. And of course, I think it's always important to remember it's 1 point for each round for each of these. So, work hard, yeah, but it's 1 point, 1 point, 1 point, 1 point. So, at most, no matter how hard you work, the best you can do is, with the exception of some of the bonus points, get 4 points in the round. So be careful not to lose sight of all the points you're going for when you do that.
You mentioned the bonus points, and those are also scored at the end of your player turn, so that's something if you can hold them. Each of the scenarios has their own bonus point. It's worth an additional point. Talking to a lot of competitive players, a lot of them feel that those bonus points are sort of a trap. And if circumstances happen and you're able to score it, go for it. But to score it more than twice in a game is pretty unlikely. Some of them, for example, in objective two, excuse me, scenario two, there are three objectives, one at board center, one in each of your deployment zones. If I hold my opponent's deployment zone and the center one, I get a bonus point. Again, if I'm playing Astra Militarum with a gun lines of Bathless and Manticores in the back row, it's probably not going to happen. I'm sitting on my objective with 2/3 of my army. And I'm also going to have a real tough time clearing a landing pad to where I can control board center and my opponent's objective in his deployment zone. Whereas if I'm playing a assault-based chaos army, I'm rushing forward, I'm going to be in his deployment zone a lot and at board center. I have more opportunities to get that particular bonus objective. So kind of mix and match. If the opportunity arises, go for it. You may need it to play catch up in terms of, and that's usually what I look at. It's like, okay, I lost that last round. How can I even this up this round? I may have to go for that second one.
Yeah. Go ahead. I think some of this is where the secondaries actually come into play too, is you see that you're having issues. Maybe you're not doing so well at holding objectives because there's just so many models on the other army, or maybe, you know, you brought a las gun to a volcano cannon fight. So you're not killing things like you'd like to. That's where the secondaries can really come into play and help turn the tables around for you. Because, you know, at the end of the game, with the exception of that fifth point bonus, you're looking at, well, let's see, 4, 6. So about 24 points that you'd be surprised how very rare people really get all those points. So those 12 points in your secondaries can really help bump your score up.
Yeah. Here's an obvious trap one. It's something that we brought. It's a mission called Crucible of Champions. I believe it is number 5 in your ITC packet. It's 5 objectives. And if you hold 3 of those objectives with models that have the character keyword, you get a bonus point. Now, the trick is that these objectives are spread out at maximum spread. So there's one at 6 inches from your deployment, from your long board edge, 36 inches in, so midway. And the other ones are 12 inches from the short end. So if you've got characters spread out that deep and your opponent has the headhunter secondary, which is killing characters, that's a great opportunity where all they have to do is kill at least 2 of your characters to get you below 3, and all of a sudden that bonus opportunity goes away. So it's another one of those. Focus on the primary, but don't focus so much on those bonuses. Those, they're cute when you pick them up, but they're, yeah, not the be-all, end-all that they think they could be.
Yeah, and that's really how they become traps. If you're scoring them, it's either, you know, it happenstance, or maybe you're just winning that good. Give you the benefit of the doubt there, but you know, you can look at some of them, like the first scenario, Seize Ground, which you get your bonus point if you're holding 5 or more objectives, and there's 6 objectives total. You're either very handily winning, or you're spreading yourself out so thin that your opponent's going to get, has a better chance of taking out units. In which case, you're probably losing that point on killing more units.
So one of the key thing you're looking also is number of objectives that are in these games. So interesting, in these 6 missions in this mission pack, there is one mission with 2 objectives, one mission with 3 objectives, 2 missions with 4 objectives, 1 with 5, 1 with 6. And that was done on purpose. It gives a wide range. Certain armies do much better with fewer objectives than others.
I'm pretty much going to say the same thing I said on secondaries, which is remember to keep track of your points. Take those few seconds after your turn when you say to your opponent, all right, it's your turn to, you know, go over. Am I holding an objective? Yes. Mark it. Be sure to mark it. Did you kill a unit? Yeah. Mark it. Get it done. That way you don't forget. And when it comes to the end of the round, do the same thing. Did you kill more? If so, mark it. Did you hold more objectives? If so, mark it. And then at the bottom of that paper, they hand out, at least in most cases, where you can keep track cumulatively. Keep marking them down. That way you get your points right. Nothing sucks more than realizing the next day or after the weekend, after the tournament's over, to realize that you completely miscounted your points and you should have won.
Another instance too is, again, I am shocked how many players do not keep track. You know, during the game. They're not keeping scores. You know, play to win. You know, the old Herman Edwards type thing. Winning by 1 point, winning by 20 points, it's win's a win. And it's these ITC format is definitely a win-loss system. So be mindful. Am I down a point? Am I tied? Where am I at this point? Where do I need to make the big play? Even in professional sports, it happened about 2 weeks ago in the NBA Finals. The player thought they had the lead and sat on the ball. And the other team staring at him like, what are you doing? We're tied. So the game went into overtime and they probably lost. So if they had just lofted, they had possession at the end of the game, which in 40K terms means they went second and they had an opportunity to either take a second objective and win by 1 point at the end of the game. Instead, he says, we're good. I'm going to go get a drink. And they played a seventh round to determine and lost it on the seventh turn. So keep that in mind. Yeah, always keep track of the score. Keep track of what's going on. And also communicate, like Ray said, with your opponent. That way you guys aren't like trying to recreate what happened earlier in the game. So everybody's on the same page as the game breaks down to the final rounds and who's at what score at what point. Because that sometimes happens a couple times. People lose track of where'd you get those points again? And if you do it turn by turn, everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, always remember, this isn't a game of solitaire. It's a social game. Even if you don't know the person, you know, hold a conversation while you're playing. Hey, I got this point. Okay. No big deal. You know, if you have to have the conversation at the end of each round, it's fine. You know, it's part of playing the game. But to have, you know, discuss it turns later or after the game, maybe you should have been paying more attention to your points too, not just to what you're doing on the table. It's just as important to keep track of how many points you got as it is to actually play the game.
From a TO's perspective, real quick, one thing we've been experimenting, and let's throw it out to all the other TOs, is actually having some sort of scoreboard at each table. Something as simple as you've got your chess clock in the middle, and then just like one of those card flips. And that way, as you score each turn, you actually just flip the cards over, and not only can spectators see what the score is, that both players are in agreement. Hey, what was the score that last round, and see where they're at. You see that a lot in video battle reports, and I thought it was very helpful. So why not do that in a live action game? So both you and your opponent know exactly where you guys stand. So hope that was helpful. Hope I live up to what you guys did last week, because last week's secondaries was a really great episode. So give it a try. Try this advice. If you have any additional advice on how you guys win primary missions or the ITC missions in general, definitely let us know on our Facebook page at Exterminatus Podcast on Facebook.com. Okay, after the break, we'll go over the ITC Top 10 as well as next week's ITC Grand Tournament and Major Events. All right, we're back in your ITC Top 10 for this week. Starting in 10th place, Chris Haynes makes his first appearance into the top 10. Let's try that again. All right, welcome back. We have your ITC Top 10 for this week. Starting in 10th place, making his first appearance in the ITC Top 10 for this season is Chris Haynes at 541 points. In 9th place, Bruce Merker, who just recently posted tonight, the ITC tournament organizers with some great questions. He's 143 points off the lead, a mere 6 points ahead of Chris Haynes. Mitch Pelham, who was in action this week at the Gentleman's GT. However, that result is not reflected in these scores. He's currently in 8th place and holds a slim 7-point lead over Bruce. In 7th place, Ryan Olson. He holds a 3-point lead over Mitch Pelham. I'm curious if he'll be able to hold that off after this weekend's events. 6th place, Nick Gower, who did extremely well this past weekend at the Dallas GT. He holds a hefty 8-point lead over Ryan Olson. And then just above him, we talked about his Gene Steeler Cult Army earlier today, John Lennon. He holds a massive 14-point lead over Nick Gower for 5th place. In fourth place, also in action this past weekend at the Gentleman's GT, TJ Lanigan. He holds a 6-point lead for fourth place over John Lennon. Then your top three, 3-point lead, you have Jeff Robinson. 3-point lead over TJ Robinson for third place. And then huge gap between these two players. Josh Death still in second place with a 40-point lead over Jeff Robinson. And in first place with a massive, we're talking 60-point lead over the second place, is none other than Matt Rutt. Holds on to that first place lead, 691 points. So he has a 150-point lead. So basically he has almost an extra event worth of points over 10th place Chris Haynes. So it looks like once again, when Matt wins the ITC, he usually builds up a huge lead and hangs on. Looks like he could be our first repeat champion for the ITC. But we have several events still coming up this season, as well as several big ones. But Ray, what do we have going on next weekend?
Next weekend, we've got the Boise Cup 2018 at ABU. Yeah, it's in Boise, Idaho. And then we've got the Flying Monkey GT that's at the Drury Plaza Hotel Broadview in Wichita, Kansas. That's all I see for GT or higher level events.
Those are two big ones, though. Weekend. So Boise, I know you're thinking like Idaho, big deal, right? That particular tournament's been around for a long time, and it pulls from the entire Pacific Northwest as well as parts of California. So expect that to be a big turnout. And the Flying Monkey GT is a great event, and we should see pretty much all the best and brightest of the Midwest circuit come together at that particular event. So we'll have lots to cover next weekend. As I mentioned, some other big events still yet to come this summer. We were only about 6 weeks away from WarGamesCon. We're about 8 weeks away from Nova. And then, not to mention, you still have some other big events in the fall. So still plenty to come. And, of course, the ATC tournament team championship is also right around the corner as well. So we talk about big leads here so far in the ITC top 10. A lot's going to change. It's still to come in for about the halfway point of the season. But we are at the end of our episode. So I want to thank you again for listening. Once again, my name's Eric. And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus podcast. I'm Raymond.